Creation-Evolution Debate, Recent Developments, by Robert C. Newman. An abstract of the talk. After sketching some favorable evidence for evolution, we ask, could so many scientists be wrong? We note that science finally depends on evidence, not opinion. We provide a look at some serious scientific problems for evolution. Several of these relate to problems generating the order known to exist in living things, with no other mechanism than random phenomena selected for survival. These problems are the origin of life, origin of specific biochemicals, origin of chemical processes and organs. We then turn to problems with the fossil record, the relative lack of transitional fossils, the shape of the fossil record, the capabilities of small populations to produce large changes, and the phenomena of punctuation statuses, and finally, the problem of islands of function. So let's go. Why do people believe in evolution? Well, there is some favorable evidence out there for evolution. It looks like we live on an old Earth, some 4 to 5 billion years old. As we look at the fossil record, as we look at the geologic record, we see that initially there's no life, and then simple life shows up in the fossil record. Then the Cambrian explosion, a sudden appearance of a wide range of body plans for the animals. Then the fish show up, then followed by the amphibians, and then by the reptiles, and by the birds and mammals, and by the apes, and finally by humans. Among these animals and plants, we find similar biochemicals among living things, and the more similar the living things look, often the more similar their biochemicals are. Among the animals, the vertebrates of the animals, we find a rather similar body plans, bone structure, if you like. We find a central spinal column with backbone and a rib cage around that, and typically four limbs. And these are four legs for most of the vertebrates, but for some of them they are two legs and two arms, or two legs and two wings. And when we look at the limb structure, whether it be a leg, an arm, or a wing, we find that the first thing coming out from the main body is a single bone, and then there's a joint, and then there's a double bone below that, and then there's a complex joint with several bones, and then a string of bones, etc. And so the proposal is that this similar structure shows that these animals are descended from a common ancestor. So those are the some of the evidences for evolution. Why doesn't everybody believe in evolution? Well, a variety of reasons, depending on one's worldview. A number of people, from their worldview, have other sources of information besides science, which raise questions for them. These are often religious, though not always. Not all object for religious reasons. For instance, Michael Denton, an Australian microbiologist, was an agnostic when I met him back in the 1980s, but he had written a book, Evolution, a Theory in Crisis, at that point, because he felt there were very serious problems with evolution as an explanation for what we see in the living world. There's Dean Kenyon, who was an author in the 60s of a book called Biochemical Predestination, in which he argued that life necessarily must arise because of the way chemistry is organized and such. As he continued to study this question, however, he came to realize that that was mistaken, that it looks very unlikely that life would arise, and he eventually moved to a theistic position because of the problems he saw in the origin of life. There's also Hubert Yockey, author of a work that looks at the information code basically found in living things, particularly in DNA, and argues that an information system like this is something that, as far as we know, always only comes from intelligent actors. So not everybody objects for religious reasons. Not all those who have religious reservations think these are the decisive problems. I have religious reservations about evolution. I'm an evangelical Protestant, a believer that the Bible is thoroughly reliable in all that it teaches. And yet, I don't think the religious problems are the decisive problems. I can imagine a god like the God of the Bible, who might do things by evolution. I have some exegetical problems. I sketched those in some detail in an article that appeared in Perspectives in Science and Christian Faith some years ago, called Some Problems for Theistic Evolution. I think the problems are scientific problems that are decisive. Well, it's fairly obvious, if you look around, that most of the scientists, or at least the spokesmen for science, etc., seem to think that evolution has really occurred. And so if we argue that evolution hasn't occurred, we raise the question, could so many scientists be wrong? And the answer there, I think, is that science must finally depend on evidence, not on opinion, not even on the opinion of experts. And the question then is, what is the evidence? Thomas Kuhn, in his work, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, noted that there's a sociology in science as well as in any other human activity. And he describes the sociology of paradigm changes in science, how in a science, as has happened a number of times in the history of science, a major structuring theory that holds things together has been abandoned, and sketches how that happens occasionally. Such an example that is fairly recent is the example of continental drift. Up until the 1950s, most geologists considered the idea that continents had moved a wacko idea, since they couldn't imagine any mechanism to do this. It was known that the east coast of South America and the west coast of Africa are very similar shaped and look like they would fit together rather well if you move them over, and things of that sort had been noticed for a long time, and yet nobody could figure out what kind of powerful process could move continents around. Well, as evidence piled up, however, as they began to look in the geologic strata of, say, South America and South Africa and Western Africa, they found that although the geologic column looked very different in the last 100 million years or so, as you went back before that, it was very parallel and seemed as though maybe they had been together back then. And evidence of this sort continued to pile up, and so in the 1950s, a rather dramatic paradigm shift did occur, so that after the 50s, most geologists consider moving continents what really happened, even though the mechanism has still not been fully worked out. So the question is, could something like that sort of thing be brewing in biology as well, that this huge paradigm of evolution, which has dominated biology for 150 years now, could that actually break up? Well, we suggest that there's some serious problems for evolution. We're concerned here with scientific problems rather than with philosophical or theological problems. Evolution has got those as well. We're concerned especially with the problems facing naturalistic evolution rather than theistic evolution. That is, the problems facing the sort of evolution espoused by Charles Darwin himself in Origin of Species. There's some argument whether Darwin believed in a god or not near the end of his life. It looks most like he was agnostic, but he certainly, in his proposal of the theory of evolution, was not intending to propose a theory where God reached in and did something every once in a while. He wanted a theory that was purely naturalistic and spoke quite strongly along those lines. So the kind of evolution espoused by Charles Darwin is the sort we're going to suggest problems facing. The kind espoused by Richard Dawkins, professor at Cambridge, biologist, who has written the book The Selfish Gene, The Blind Watchmaker, Climbing Mount Impossible, and such, and by the philosopher Daniel Dennett, who's written the work Darwin's Dangerous Idea. So those are the things we're concerned with. Concerned with problems, scientific problems, facing naturalistic evolution, blind watchmaker evolution. We're going to deal here in our talk with two main problems, which will include various sub-problems. These two main problems would be, one, problems with generating the observed level of order that we see in living things, given a mindless universe, and therefore given only random events, no mind guiding which events take place, and selection for survival to pick out of these random events the ones which will generate this order. And two, problems with the observed fossil record compared to what one would expect from a universe with no minds in it until they evolve. So let's look at those. Problems generating order using merely random phenomena selected for survival. The first big problem is the origin of life. And the origin of life is a big problem because the basic model, the basic, driving force, if you like, of evolution, mutation, and natural selection, won't work until there's something capable of reproducing for mutation to work upon. And you have to somehow, by brute randomness, construct something capable of reproducing before mutation and natural selection will kick in. When you look in detail at the minimum complexity of self-replicating automata, that is, machines, understood in some biological sense, that are capable of making copies themselves, the minimal complexity of self-replicating automata is beyond the capability of chance over the entire history of the universe. I look at this in some more detail in our Computer Viruses, Artificial Life, and the Origin of Life, another one of our PowerPoint talks on our IBRI website, so you might want to have a look at that in thinking about this particular problem. Computer viruses are, after all, the closest things to life that humans have created. Mark Ludwig, in his book Computer Viruses, Artificial Life and Evolution, has pointed out that even the simplest of computer viruses are far too complex to form by chance, and he works out some probabilities from the simplest computer viruses that have been devised so far. Another problem related to origins is the origin of biochemicals. Life is made up, all the life we know about, is made up of biochemicals, and one of the early experiments that was thought to be a huge breakthrough in this direction was that experiment by Stanley Miller. As a young grad student under Harold Urey, he performed an experiment in which he built a circuit of chemical piping, chemical tubing, in which he passed methane, ammonia, water, and hydrogen gases past a reaction chamber in which there was an electric spark, and this spark then would break up these molecules into their component subpieces, whether they be elements or whether they be ions of one sort or another. And as these then were cooled off, they would recombine, and a lot of them would recombine into methane, ammonia, water, and hydrogen gases, but others would recombine into other things. And after a week or so, he found in his mixture that was in there that there were amino acids. And so this was felt to be the step showing that these sort of things could form. And basically, Miller's argument was that the methane, ammonia, water, and hydrogen gases emulated the early Earth's atmosphere. The spark emulated a lightning bolt or perhaps ultraviolet or hot lava, something of that sort. And he was showing basically how to build up the building blocks for life on the early Earth. This, of course, however, was a very small first step. When you think of the fact that a functional protein, which there are many different kinds of living things, have over 100 amino acids apiece in very specific order. Miller had produced two or three. There are about 20 different amino acids that occur in the proteins of living things. He had produced just two or three. Over the course now of about 50 years since Miller's experiment, we still haven't produced all 20 of the amino acids that occur, and even producing some of the different ones here require rather different situations. On top of that, we've realized that methane, ammonia, water, and hydrogen gas does not appear to be a very close approximation to the atmosphere of the early Earth, and the closer approximations appear to be the sort that won't produce this sort of thing. So that's a huge problem, the origin of biochemicals. Making DNA and RNA is far harder than making amino acids. And DNA and RNA, of course, are the information molecules and quite crucial to living things. The DNA and RNA provide the information for what kind of proteins you make, and you actually need a working together, a symbiosis of the DNA, the RNA, and the proteins to actually get anything to occur. Making DNA and RNA, as we say, is far harder. These require a number of different environments. Robert Shapiro, in his book Origins, has given a rather humorous picture of the sort of changes in environment you would need to construct something like DNA or RNA, and I recommend you read that sometime. And yet, Shapiro himself still is an evolutionist and believes that life arose by chance, luckily, but that we aren't anywhere near figuring out how. Well, to date, attempts to assemble DNA and RNA have been produced only by using considerable intervention by the experimenter. And intervention by the experimenter is, after all, what intelligent design is all about. So the origin of biochemicals looks more like an argument for intelligent design than an argument for unguided evolution. Related to this whole thing, we have the problem of handedness as well. The amino acids in living things are left-handed, whereas when you make amino acids non-biological situations, you're going to come out with equal number of left and right-handed sort. I should have a little diagram there showing you what the left and right-handed version of the simplest amino acid that has handedness looks like. The very simplest amino acid has not got any handedness, but all the ones above that do. So the amino acids in living things are left-handed. The sugars in DNA and RNA are right-handed. And the question is, how do you get this sort of thing to happen? Well, in life, we know how it happens. That is, that life is made up of little nano machines inside your cells, and these things construct amino acids that are only left-handed and construct sugars that are only right-handed and then put them together. Undirected chemical processes such as occur in a universe without a mind, produce equal numbers of left and right-handed. And so once you start talking about putting together a amino acid of, say, 80 or 90 amino acids, excuse me, a protein of 80 or 90 amino acids, you suddenly realize that even getting the handedness right is something that is going to be astronomically unlikely. Besides the origin of life and the origin of biochemicals, the origin of various chemical processes and complex organs in living things is a difficult thing to see how that's going to happen in a mindless universe as well. We have here the problem of a large minimal complexity that is needed to make certain chemical processes and certain complex organs work. We're here thinking of minimal or complexity for something to work, or what Michael Behe calls irreducible complexity. He gives the example of a mouse trap as an analogy. A mouse trap consists of several parts. We see here the traditional mouse trap, if you like, a wooden base on which are stapled several parts, which include the hammer, which hits the mouse in the back of the neck when the trap goes off, and the bar that holds the hammer from flipping over, the spring that actually makes the hammer flip over, and then the bar is attached to a trigger, and the trigger, if it is moved by the mouse, then fires off, and the bar flies up, and the hammer comes over and whacks the mouse. Of the parts pictured here, only the bait is something that is not needed for minimal complexity or for irreducible complexity. A mousetrap will work without bait, but you're not likely to get the mouse to poke the right part without the bait. But if you put a little piece of bacon or perhaps cheese or a dab of peanut butter on there, then the mouse is likely to come over and sniff it and set the whole thing off. The thing about a mouse trap that represents this irreducible complexity or minimal complexity is that it must have all of the parts that we call irreducible in order to function, which in this case is everything but the bait. Can you make a mouse trap with fewer parts? Yes, indeed. Different design, okay? The simplest mouse trap currently in use is a mouse trap that has just a bait with a base with a strong adhesive on it, and probably some kind of bait in the middle of the thing to attract mice. When the mouse steps on the base with his adhesive, the mouse gets stuck and can't get off, and the mouse is then trapped. Huh? But that's a very different design. And we're illustrating here minimal complexity, irreducible complexity, not suggesting that there might be simpler designs, because we're looking at the actual designs we see in living things. Well, the problem of processes, chemical processes in organs, is how will evolution, working by single mutations, build a system that requires many features working together to have any function? An example shown here is the rotary motor, of which there are several in each bacterium we call the E. coli. These motors power a little whip that sticks outside the E. coli into the water through which they swim. And this whip, spinning around, whipping around, functions as kind of a propeller of a motor. And so the E. coli has these rotary motors. Well, many parts to make these things work. You take out any of the parts, they don't work, okay? And the question is, how do you mutate into such a thing where you need at each step along the way something that is favorable for survival when you don't get function until you've got all the parts? That, in a word, is the problem of irreducible complexity. Some other examples which Michael Behe gives us in his Darwin's Black Box are the blood clotting mechanism, the intracell transport, the chemistry of vision just from the light to the first electrical signal. I'm not getting into all of the complexities of an eyeball. And these are discussed in some detail in Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box. Blood clotting mechanism, a cascade of chemical reactions such that blood doesn't clot when it's inside your veins, but once it gets out, something then triggers it, air presumably, triggers it so that it does clot. Intracell transport, a rather sophisticated packaging system, if you like, that gets chemicals made in one part of the cell to the place where they're needed in another part of the cell by labeling them and by having little nanomachines move them around. Well, those are the problems we sketch for the problems of generating order in a universe where there's no mind, and we suggest that they're insuperable, that these sort of things, in fact, are an indication that we do live in a universe that had a mind behind it when life began. The second set of problems are what we call problems with the fossil record, given only purely natural causes, given a universe with no minds in it until minds evolved. What kind of problems? Well, one of these is the relative lack of transitional fossils in the fossil record. Here we have a quotation from Stephen Jay Gould in Natural History magazine back in 1977. Gould says the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as a trade secret of paleontology, that people outside of the area of fossil studies aren't generally aware of this. The evolutionary trees, he goes on, that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. And the problem here of extreme rarity of transitional forms. David Raup, a couple of years later in the Field Museum Bulletin, says, well, we're now about 120 years after Darwin. Ironically, we have even fewer examples of evolutionary transitions than we did in Darwin's time. By this I mean that some of the classic cases have had to be discarded or modified. He's saying that in the 120 years since Darwin, instead of filling up all the gaps in the fossil record by finding intermediates, now we have fewer transitions. Some of them that were thought to be transitions don't now appear to be. Rather disastrous. About the same time, Stephen Stanley, in the book Macroevolution, Patterns and Process, says despite the detailed study of the Pleistocene mammals of Europe, the mammals of Europe in the last geological period before this one, not a single valid example is known of phyletic or gradual transition from one genus to another. genus down near the bottom of the biological classification system, just above species. And though there seem to be some examples of gradual transitions from one species to another, he doesn't think there are any valid examples of gradual transitions from one genus to another. Well, notice in this headings here, we've been calling it relative lack of transitional fossils. Why is that? Well, because there's no need to argue that there are no fossils which might be transitional. Indeed, it's possible that in the history of life, transitions occurred, but that there are too few transitional fossils to have occurred by the Darwinian blind watchmaker means, the means that only means you've got available in a universe without minds. The problem here is that Darwinian blind watchmaker evolution has only what we call a random walk to cross the gaps between the fossils that we have. The fossil record looks like the transitions are not random walks, but something much more rapid than that. I call them here sudden in my PowerPoint here. I mean geologically sudden. We can't tell whether they're sudden like that. What's a random walk? Well, a random walk is something that physicists and engineers talk about now and then. It's illustrated for us rather humorously in this cartoon from George Gamow's book 1, 2, 3, Infinity. A random walk is a movement in which steps are taken in random directions and often of random length. Gamow's illustration is a drunk trying to find his way home from a streetlight pole, and the diagram shows the various different directions that he's walking as he's trying in his fuzzy way to make his way home. Now, Gamow raises the problem not of how long it would take the drunk to get home, which probably won't be until he becomes sober, but how far will the drunk walk from the pole in the course of so many steps? And whereas if the person were sober and was planning to go in one particular direction, the distance that the person would cover from the pole would be the average length of a step times the number of steps. For the drunk doing a random walk, the distance covered would be the average length of the step times the square root of the number of steps. So for a person taking 100 steps, a drunk person will travel only about the distance of about 10 steps, that is the square root, whereas a sober person would travel 10 times that far. So that's basically the picture, and with a random walk, you also don't know what direction the movement is going to wind up being as well. Well, the picture here then is mutations are by definition random walks. You don't know in which direction a mutation will take an organism, and there's no reason to believe the next mutation will take it in that same direction, and you don't know how far it will go in each of these steps either. Oh, the whole point of that then is that with random walk as the means of transition, enormous number of intermediate steps have to be taken, and therefore one would expect an enormous number of intermediate fossils to show up in the record. Well, Darwin and many since his time have argued that the fact we don't see so many transitions in the fossil record is due really to the fragmentary nature of the fossil record, not to the fact that there were so few steps actually taken. Fragmentary fossil record. But how fragmentary is the fossil record? Well, probably fairly fragmentary, but we do have to say that there are nearly a quarter billion fossils collected and housed in museums around the world, not counting, of course, all the other fossils that are in individual hands or have never been dug out of the ground or things of that sort. If we look at this from the perspective of computer graphics, we can ask ourselves the question, how detailed a picture can one construct with a quarter billion pixels? Well, let's take a little illustration of that. Here, if you're looking at the PowerPoint, we have a picture of a blooming cherry tree, a cherry blossom on a tree. And this particular picture, rather fuzzy looking, is made with 6,700 pixels And you can tell it's a blossoming tree, and probably could guess that it's a cherry tree that's blossoming. Here is the same picture taken at the same time in 190,460 pixels. And you can see a great deal more evidence, a pretty sharp picture. Well, the fossil record, by contrast, has got more than 1,000 times as many pixels, if you like, as this sharper picture here does. And you would therefore expect it would pick up lots of transitional information. Where is it? I'll come back to that in a bit. The shape of the fossil record. We suggest that the shape of the fossil record is not what would be expected by blind watchmaker type evolution. Darwinism predicts a tree of life, that is, a diagram of the diverging different sorts of living things, predicts a tree of life formed by divergence of species into genera, etc., on up the fossil record, on up in time, with the largest differences occurring last. And on the right-hand side here in these diagrams, we see phyletic gradualism, kind of the standard old Darwinian and neo-Darwinian model, phyletic gradualism, very small changes. And then the more recent punctuated equilibrium model, in which the changes take place rather suddenly and are pretty big, but then you have stasis. We'll come back and talk about each of those. And yet you still get the same general shape of the fossil record. And that's thing again, that is, it starts out with basically one basic kind, and this gradually diverges into varieties, and these diverge enough to become different species, and these diverge enough to become different genera, and we go on up the level there as well. What we actually see, however, is the fossil record, the third picture below, and we see stuff that does look somewhat like the punctuated equilibrium, but there's big spaces between the major body plans. The actual data, in fact, shows the largest differences showing up first at the Cambrian explosion. Another picture of this is shown here in this superimposed diagram here, the Darwinian prediction and the fossil record here with the turquoise background. And you see, instead of getting one tree, you're getting a bunch of bushes, if you like. Not the shape of the fossil record that blind watchmaker Darwinism would propose. Well, that's a problem that no obvious reason why it's going to go away. Basically, evolutionists have proposed that those bushes all connect back down further, and just for some strange reason, we get this big divergence at the time of the Cambrian explosion. Another explanation has been proposed for why there are so few transitional fossils in the fossil record is the effect of small populations. It's pointed out that a particular mutation is likely to become dominant, more likely to become dominant in a small population than it is in a large one. And so Darwin has used this fact, which is a fact, okay, to argue that all the significant transitions took place in small populations so that we would not expect them to show up in the fossil record. What the Darwinists have in mind here can be seen very easily thinking about coin flips. If you have a small population of coin flips, you say flip one coin 10 times, so your population is 10, then if it's fair coin, you're going to have probably around half and half heads and tails, but you wouldn't be too surprised that instead of 5 and 5, you got 6 and 4 or something like that, maybe even 7 and 3, because that's only 10 flips. But if you had a large population, if you flip the coin 100 times or 1,000 times, it would be very strange to have anything like that kind of divergence. At 100, you might well expect 49, 51, 47, 53, something of that sort, but you would not expect 40 and 60 if you've got a fair coin. And all the more so at 1,000, you would not expect 400 and 600 if you've got a fair coin. So populations are so Darwinists argue that with small populations, a random mutation takes place might catch hold because the same sort of thing that when you flip a coin 10 times, you might just get 7 and 3 instead of 5 and 5. So used by Darwinists to argue all the significant transitions took place in small populations, we wouldn't expect them to show up in the fossil record. Well, that's okay for single mutations. It becomes very difficult, though, once you think about how many mutations you need to actually produce anything significantly different. Now, for transitions across the upper levels of the biological classification scheme, different body plans, wings instead of legs, that sort of thing, many mutations would be needed. Probably hundreds or thousands of mutations are needed to move across some kind of a divergence in design like that. Well, the chance of getting five mutations of the right sort in a population varies with the fifth power of the population size. So getting five mutations of the sort needed for some result is going to be far more likely in a large population than a small population. Getting 10 mutations of the right sort varies with the tenth power of the population size. So again, large populations are heavily favored. So the problem of multiple mutations more than cancels out the benefit of a small population. Been talking about the biological classification scheme. We talked a little bit earlier about the gradual transition seemed to only show up at the species level and not make it up the genus level. And here we're talking about body plans and such. Up the upper end, here is biological classification of a dog. Belongs to the kingdom. That's the highest classification, if you like. Animals. The other alternatives would be plants and then a couple of single cell types of beings. Then inside the animal kingdom, there's the phylum, chordates, animals that have their nerve system in a long cord, and then a subphylum under that called vertebrates, where that cord is protected by bone. And then under that, the class mammals, the animals that, among other things, suckle their young. The young feed on milk from the mother. And then among the mammals, dogs belong to the carnivores, the ones that eat meat as their prime food, if you like. And then among the carnivores, that divides up, and the dogs belong to the category canidae, dog-like, as opposed to, for instance, cat-like. And then the genus, finally, is the dog proper, canis. And then the particular species, the familiaris, the common dog, the familiar dog, if you like. So there's what we're talking about, the lower part of the biological classification scheme, species, genus, family, and the higher part, kingdom, phylum, class, etc. So that for your edification. Now, since 1970s, there's been some interest in another proposal regarding evolution that would still have it in a mindless universe, but is suggested would fit the fossil record far better than the old Darwinian evolution and the neo-Darwinian model that was formed in the 1930s. And this is the idea of punctuated equilibria. Gould and Eldridge and others in the 1970s noted that the fossil record typically shows sudden transitions to new forms rather than gradual ones. They weren't talking about that kind of transition, instantaneous transition, but a transition that still looks sudden in the fossil record. And so they proposed punctuated equilibrium as a model to explain the sudden transitions and then the stasis, which we'll mention in a moment. In fact, punctuated equilibrium does picture the fossil record a lot better than the gradualistic evolution does. But geneticists have not been able to figure out how such transitions could occur and be viable. Yes, you can make any size transition if you want occur. The question is, how would you have enough transitions, enough mutations of the right sort so that when you make some big change, the big change is actually functional. So geneticists have not been able to figure out how such transitions could occur. The result is that this feature, punctuation, does not favor evolution as an undirected process. A directed process in which some mind caused the right mutations to clump together so that a big change could occur rather quickly, but that's something else that we can imagine rather easily. Not clear how it would happen, but we can imagine that. Another feature of the punctuated equilibrium scheme is stasis. This feature, noted by Gould and others, is that living forms, after appearing suddenly, typically remain about the same until they become extinct. This suggests that mutation and natural selection is basically a conservative process rather than an innovative one. It protects things from changing. And that, in fact, is confirmed by computer simulation. I've done a little work with a program I devised that basically on your computer, you type in a sentence, and then the computer makes a random change in it, and you, as the, what shall we say, natural selection, select the mutation over against the original only if the mutation still spells something, the sentence that is mutated still works properly, means something, all its words spell something, and such. When you do that, you find that a mutation and natural selection for something that is functional, like a sentence, even a short sentence, that mutation and natural selection is basically a conservative process rather than an innovative one. Another problem related to the fossil record relates to the question of imagining in your mind the structures of living things and thinking, well, around each design that we've actually got are all the alternative designs that are nearest to it, are they functional or not? And the answer to that is certainly most of them are not. That living organisms and the fossil record suggest that each living thing is surrounded by many alternative designs that will work. And that's why you don't see kind of just anything in the fossil record. You see working things. Okay? Undirected evolution, blind watchmaker evolution, evolution in a universe where there's no lines, has to assume that these islands of function are actually land bridges, so that you can get from one functional one to another by single mutations, or that they're at least close enough that one mutation can jump the gap. Once they get far enough apart that you need two or three of the right mutations to jump the gap, the probabilities of getting anything to work, of getting this stuff to happen, are virtually zero, unless the evolution is not undirected. How does one reach the new innovations that we know have actually occurred in the history of life, however? How do we get from a two-chambered to a three-chambered to a four-chambered heart? We find all of these different kinds of features in different living things. And how does an intermediate work? You know, is that going to happen? How do you get from push-pull lungs, such as we have and reptiles have, etc., to flow-through lungs, such as birds have? Push-pull lung, the air comes in and out the same passage. Flow-through lung, it comes in one side of the lung and goes out the other side of the lung. Huh? How do you get that? How do you get from black and white vision to color vision? How do you get from legs to wings and have something that's viable, competable as the intermediates? Huh? How do you get from scales to feathers? Many such items really have no intermediate forms and numerous coordinated changes would be necessary for each to work. You're getting from one example of irreducible complexity to another, right? And doesn't look like that sequences of simple mutations are going to do that. Well, we're going to try to pull this together here. We've looked at two basic problems. Problems generating order, and we looked at the origin of life, the origin of specific biochemicals, and the origins of processes and chemical processes and organs, and basically suggested that a blind watchmaker evolution does not have the resources to solve these particular problems. They depend upon chance, and they depend upon enormously small chances to get this stuff to work. And yet we see the enormous diversity of living things out there. These things have obviously happened in the history of life. The other is problems with the fossil record, and we looked at the relative lack of transitional fossils, and not so few that there might not have been transitions, but few enough that the transitions certainly do not look like they happened by random walk. And what else have you got in a mindless universe? The shape of the fossil record doesn't look right either. You have the major diversity occurring very suddenly in the Cambrian explosion, a period of less than 10 million years, over 500 million years ago. You get all the body plans for animals
and really got no new one since. What is going on there? It doesn't look like something that happened by chance. It looks like some kind of design, if you like. The inadequacy of small populations to explain how you get a whole series of mutations that you need to go from one fairly diverse thing to another. The fact that punctuation and stasis seem to describe the fossil record rather well, but do not, in fact, seem to work, that is, you get into probabilistic problems again, again suggests, I think, that we're looking at, on the one hand, some evidence of intelligent guidance of what happened in the punctuations, and the conservative nature of mutation and natural selection when you look at the stasis. And finally, the whole area of islands of function. The fact that, as far as we can tell, functional designs of any sort in animals, plants, or in human artifacts are things that are surrounded by a large number of designs that won't work. And how do you get from one design that will work to another design that will work, except by some kind of intelligent guidance? Well, of course, if you're determined to hold on to a worldview in which there's no God, there's no mind behind the universe, then undirected evolution has to be your explanation, no matter how badly it works. But one would think that if it works badly enough, that maybe one should rethink one's worldview. Consider, however, this remark by noted evolution Richard Lewontin from New York Review of Books of January 9, 1997. Lewontin says, "We take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. It's not that the methods and institutions somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, we're forced by our a priori adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door." Lewontin's statement is pretty, what shall we say, dogmatic. It explains some of the wrath that you're hearing now concerns by many that some kind of intelligent design should be taught in our public schools, at least as an alternative. There are people who cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Well, if you're in that position, you may never change, no wonder what the data looks like until the last judgment, when it'll be a little late. If you're determined to hold on to a worldview in which there's no God, undirected evolution must be your explanation, no matter how badly it works. But if you admit these problems indicate a mind behind the universe, then that mind might have worked by natural processes or abrupt means, and we would have to look at the evidence to see which, huh? But, of course, having a mind behind the universe, having a God, raises the question of what life is all about and what I'm going to do about it. And there are a lot of people who do not want to face that particular question. Well, that's something to think about. Some further reading, because a talk like this can't cover all the details. Michael Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box. William Dembski's book, Intelligent Design. Michael Denton's book, Nature's Destiny. J.P. Moreland's book, Mere Creation. Hugh Ross's book, The Creator and the Cosmos. Hubert Yockey's book, Information Theory and Molecular Biology. A simpler treatment designed for high school biology students, cartoon format, is the book by myself and John Wiester, What's Darwin Got to Do with It? With some very huge help from our cartoonist Janet Moneymaker and her husband Jonathan, who helped out with some of the logical work and transitions, etc. What's Darwin Got to Do with It? Think about it.